Oxford University has been involved in podcasting for some time, but they've had to significantly increase the volume of their podcasting content with the recent arrival of public-facing channels like iTunes U and YouTube. Pete Robinson manages the Learning Technologies Services team at the Computing Services Department at Oxford University. And one of his roles is to manage podcasting activity across Oxford's many portals and channels.
Oxford's interested in podcasting because we're a global university. A very large percentage of our students comes from abroad. A lot of our researchers and staff also research on a global stage. And it's part of our vision, really, as a university to try and make sure our outputs, our knowledge is shared amongst the widest audience possible. And with that, you have to think to yourself, how can we represent the best of our university in a format that other people can see and use easily?
We've been using audio for learning and teaching for a long time, and the technology of podcasting is a logical progression for me. Listening and speaking has always been part of the learning conversation, and podcasting technology makes it easier to do that and make that available in different ways. But it's a very sensible and logical part of using technology to support learning.
Melissa Highton is the head of the Learning Technologies Group.
Before I came to Oxford, I worked at another very good university, Leeds University, and we were doing pedagogical podcasting there as well. In fact, I think some of the early pioneering podcasting was coming out of Leeds. And so for me, it's not a surprise when academics want to do podcasting. I expect academics at the top of their game to be interested in the use of new technologies. That doesn't surprise me. What surprises me at Oxford was particularly pleasing is the scale of the uptake, and that to do with the various projects that we've had here, I think has been some of the big successes that colleagues can see each other doing it, and it's very much part of accepted academic practice. So at Oxford, what are we doing? We do research, and we're interested in making that research available on a global scale. We want to attract and include the best students and staff in our organisation, and making podcasts and putting those out there is very much part of that activity.
Oxford's a very, very big university with many different colleges, many different departments scattered across the whole of the city centre. It's a research-led institution, so there's many different conferences, lectures, public guest appearances happening every single day. And what we try to do here at Oxford to run a podcasting service is to have a small team at the centre that can act as a coordination unit to make sure that everybody who wants to get involved in podcasting at a university can find information and understand the processes and the workflow and get training, have a little bit of hand-holding. Often in a department, the people there are closer to the activities and know what the communication strategies are and know how much effort to put into certain work that's relevant to themselves. So what we try and do is come up with a framework that allows people out in the departments to take ownership of the podcasting. And if they wish to have a little bit of training to help them perhaps on the IT side of things for recording or to understand what the legal workflow is, then we make sure we have a regular series of talks. Every 2 or 3 weeks we run a simple Q&A training session, and we also run 3-hour sessions on editing audio and recording audio. We run video filmmaking courses regularly as well, and some very basic introduction to podcasting courses. So probably over a year and a half to 2 years, we've had well over 300 staff from different departments come through these courses, and they're part of what we call our podcasting community.
One member of Oxford's podcasting community is Simon Benjamin, a researcher in the materials department.
I'm part of a research effort that actually spans many of the departments in an area called quantum computing, which is a lot more fun than it sounds. We sort of realised that the area that we're working in is something that people like to hear about. It's interesting to people from the sort of physics-y and chemistry end, but if you tell the story the right way, it can be interesting to pretty much anyone. And so we thought that what we could do is make a podcast, a video podcast, and also have an audio version of it. So try and produce it in such a way that the audio pretty much makes sense without the video. whilst focusing on making the video version the definitive one, that really just explains why the research is exciting and where we've got to so far. Because what we do is try and work with, let's say, components of this new technology, which are really at the molecular scale. That's what's called the nanoscale, and it's this whole phrase nanotechnology, which is quite a fashionable phrase at the moment. So I called the podcast Quantum Nanotechnology, but I also called it Caging Schrödinger's Cat, because there's a very famous thought experiment, meaning not something you're supposed to actually try to do, but something to illustrate the weirdness of the science, called Schrödinger's Cat. It's a story about a cat that ends up both dead and alive at the same time. And so we conceived really of making a short series of video podcasts along these lines. Fortunately, we'd just done an exhibit for an exhibition in London run by the Royal Society, which was designed to take people through some of the interesting ideas with some hands-on bits, like, you know, molecules that you can wave around. And we'd also even commissioned some computer-generated animation to illustrate a couple of the points that couldn't really be done with kind of hands-on models. So we had that material. And that exhibit was scheduled to be taken apart because the exhibition had finished. So what I did was I grabbed one of the AV guys from the university. It was really very easy. And I ran through the exhibit explaining everything in such a way that the whole explanation took about half an hour. And that gave us the raw material, which we quickly reviewed to make sure that the sound, in particular the sound, is something that's very hard to get right. I think that people tolerate a bit of shakiness, a bit of poor focus, a bit of, you know, wonky angle with the video. We're used to seeing that sort of thing on YouTube and so on. But if the sound is not good, if the sound has some artifact like an annoying buzz, then that really ruins the experience. We reviewed it to make sure that the material was basically usable. And then I talked to some of the guys here, including Pete, on how best to turn that into podcasts. And he sort of reviewed it and said, well, there's a lot of stuff here. Why don't you present it as a bunch of smaller ideas? And already that was a bit of a learning thing for me, because if I'd have thought of that in the first place, I would have put natural breaks in. Well, I got some software called Final Cut Pro, which is very nice to use, and that allowed me to fairly easily edit together this half hour of material, or rather break it up, into sort of 5 to 10 minute sections, each of which introduced one kind of idea in the story of how we go from the idea of this new kind of technology through the ways that we might try and build it at the moment at the prototype level through to the grand vision of what it will do for us one day if we get the thing working. And I was also able to use these computer-generated graphics that we'd got done for the exhibition and weave those in as well, which kind of gave it a bit of a, you know, a bit of fun to watch. And the fact that it was in 5 to 10 minute sections also, I think, helped people to just pace it. So that even though it was only half an hour, maybe if it's you're in your own spare time, you don't really necessarily want to watch half an hour of dense ideas coming across to you. But if they're made interesting enough, then you watch a couple of them and you just think, oh, yeah, I'll just see how that story finished. I had a version that I was happy with. So what I would do is I would export it as a fairly high-quality file, too big, really, to be used as a podcast, because we're always concerned about the bandwidth for download. So I sent that file over to OUCS, and the guys re-encoded it using some hardware they have here to be at a smaller size, and they simply put it onto iTunes U for me. I have no idea what's involved in that stage. I gather it's pretty easy. I supplied the text for the description, and for the album artwork, we simply took a screenshot from one of the frames of the film, and then they took care of the rest of it and just gave me the kind of download figures and so on, which was interesting to see.
So was the effort of producing these podcasts worthwhile for Simon?
I think it was very successful. I mean, I've been able to put it on my CV as something that I've done. These days, there's a lot of encouragement from all the funding agencies to try and do as much outreach as possible. And just on a more personal level, it's exciting to know that it's getting that many views. When I give a lecture, maybe I lecture, say, 70 people, and that's quite rewarding, but it's another thing altogether to have 50,000 downloads of this. And I know that most of these guys are just watching it, you know, as a sort of just for a bit of fun, and they'll probably forget it in a few days' time. But still, it's exciting to think that the work we put into the exhibit and into just working out how to explain things is being seen and appreciated by so many people.
Back in Oxford's computing service, Pete Robinson and his team are able to support podcasting colleagues like Simon with the back-end part of the process.
So the Podcasting probably has three or four basic kind of stages it goes through. You've got to record the actual conversation or the lecture, and that's the first simple stage to get going. And then you need to basically put that online, so it's got a public URL. Now, we at the Centre have got a place that people can use to actually deposit their material, so it's online, or in the department they might actually have a server themselves for doing that. The third stage is what's unique to podcasting, and that's making some cataloguing information that points to the file and tells the viewer what the material is. And that's really the syndication, the RSS side of things. And again, at the Centre, we've got a service that allows a person to catalogue the material once they've placed it online. So that third step is really basically saying, here's the correct markup for putting a podcast up online, and here's the information, the keywords, the title, and a bit of description. And then the very final stage is the checking stage. You need to just check and validate the material's fine, it sounds okay, the quality's good, everything's as it should be, and we basically tick a few boxes that allow it then to surface across different channels such as Oxford on iTunes U or the podcasting website. So really we're trying to say, help us out in the departments by doing some of the things that you can do better than we can, which might be recording or might just be some of the descriptions and the category stuff. If you can do that, that's great and it'll save time. But if that's an extra step too far, then we at the Centre are quite happy to come in and help work with you to make sure the material gets online. So we really don't want to lose any of the good material. So it's, as always, it's a bit of a trade-off between costs and time, but we try and facilitate as much material as we can. Part of the podcasting workflow, obviously, is to release the material, and that's basically a paperwork step which says the academic involved is quite happy to make the material available globally in a public format as a podcast. And at Oxford, it's slightly more unusual than perhaps many other institutions that the university doesn't take ownership of any lectures automatically. So really, we like to think of the academic donating their material to the service that allows it to be reused in education worldwide. I think this is great because it really is a partnership between the people themselves and the university. So we like to feel that everybody in the university who's contributing material is really donating that material to make it available for personal learning out there in the wider world. And this is great. We've got some fantastic speakers at Oxford University. We've got great research happening out in the departments. And if you're a young person, maybe you're 16, 17, and you're thinking about going to university, to be able to hear the best people in the subject area giving talks for free that can be downloaded to your media player or your iPod, it's really inspiring you. It's helping you get into the subject and understand what the subject's all about. To hear the day-to-day research as it's coming out of the university is quite inspirational, particularly, I think, to young people.
Oxford now has a very successful podcasting community, spanning the numerous colleges and departments. And over the last couple of years, have seen around 1,500 recordings coming through their podcasting systems. How does an institution like Oxford make sure these podcasts reflect the quality of the teaching and learning at the university?
Okay, that's a really good question. When you're considering podcasting at an institutional level, you've obviously got to think about how do you show your university in the best possible light? How do you make sure that your material is excellent and of a high quality and reflects really well on the departments and the teaching that goes on day to day in the university? And that, of course, is what it's all about. There's trust involved. I mean, we trust the people out in the departments. The professors in the departments and the researchers are usually experts in their field and have spent many, many years talking about their own work. And they act as a kind of first area of quality control.
The podcasts that we record at Oxford University reflect the academic activity of the institution. Most of it is not created specially for the podcasts. We're recording activities that are going on anyway. So to a certain extent, those are quality assured by the fact that they are part of the academic activity of Oxford. So the people who are speaking and what they're speaking about are the researchers who are working and writing and publishing in that field. The legal sign-off and the permission for that to go up on the web is devolved to head of department. And that is an academic decision, a senior academic decision, rather than a central decision. We review all of the material here But that's largely for sound quality, for hiccups, for slides that feature copyright material or such things. We wouldn't be making decisions on the academic quality, and that really is the responsibility of the content creator, who is the academic in the department. And that is a healthy way to manage podcasting in an institution like this.
There's trust involved, that you know that people in the department are always going to try and show the department off in a good light and provide high quality material. And I think that's something that all institutions need to think about, how they can make sure there's a nice clear workflow for everybody involved to understand what you're trying to achieve to show the best of your institution.
The range of podcasts now available across Oxford's many podcasting sites is wide and varied. What do Pete and Melissa feel have been the university's most successful podcasts?
I think when you're looking at podcasting, and you must reflect and think what's actually worked really well in the medium. And of course, you know, there's a long history in broadcasting of radio. And in the early days of the radio, they realised that very scripted pieces sometimes didn't seem to sit well with a listener out there in their home. And we've learned the same thing about podcasting at Oxford. The format of podcasting lends itself very well to conversational type of material. So my own personal favourite is just getting two professors sat in a room talking about their research. They both know their stuff inside out. You've got a unique set of circumstances that no other medium actually replicates. Two people in that room at the same time having a very challenging intellectual conversation about where they think their research is going, what are the challenges, what lies ahead of them in the future. And because it's two people chatting and interjecting with each other, then it's really engaging material. And it's unique, it will possibly never happen again. And that is actually quite a simple thing to record.
And these are unique learning resources because they are created by the fact that these two academics are at Oxford at the same time and that they are together and talking about it. And often during the interviews, they will refer to how the work of other researchers at Oxford, again, will be influencing the way they're thinking. And being at Oxford is about joining an academic community. This is a university with a very strong sense of place. You have to be here in these buildings at this time with these people. And that's the experience that we're offering. So the podcasts that capture those unique moments in time, I think, are the very valuable learning resources that we can make available and shift the time and place in which they are available. So the experience of the face-to-face experience is limited to a lucky few staff and students, but the content, when we podcast it, can be available to everyone.
This podcast was produced by the Open University for the Steeple Project, funded by JISC.